This is the Beltline to Broadway podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Mike Wiley and Howard Kraft. Hi, everyone. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, and this is Beltline to Broadway. This week marks Juneteenth, which commemorates the day when federal troops arrived in Galveston, Texas in 1865 to take control of the state and ensure that all enslaved people be freed. That happened 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. It is a day that honors the end of slavery and those who fought for freedom. But so many of us have been spoon-fed a diet of whitewashed and watered-down history that we just don't understand. And that is why we need historians and master storytellers like Howard Kraft and Mike Wiley to teach us what we don't know so we can visualize a better tomorrow, not just for us, but for our children. Now, as you'll hear, I found myself apologizing to Mike Wiley for not knowing the story of Abraham Galloway, a freedom fighter Mike portrays in Howard Kraft's play, The Fire of Freedom. The play is based on the book of the same name by David Soselsky and was published in 2012, nearly 150 years after Abraham Galloway met with President Abraham Lincoln to argue for African-American citizenship and equality. And that is where my conversation with Mike Wiley and Howard Kraft begins. Here's Mike.
Most North Carolinians don't know who Abraham Galloway was, right? And it's because of folks like David Soselsky and Howard, you know, bringing this story to the forefront in a way that gives it breath, gives it life, and allows us to learn more about him and know who he was in a way that even the for a long time, the state wasn't even telling us the story of Abraham Galloway, right? The kids aren't learning it in school. They still aren't, by and large, learning it in the schools. And I think that's where, you know, this play and David's book come in really important, not just handy, but really important to be able to tell this story, to be able to let kids know, especially black kids, let them know that there was somebody out there like Abraham Galloway. He wasn't the only one, but there was somebody out there like Abraham Galloway that they can research, look up to, and look back in that history and identify with.
And you shouldn't feel any kind of way about not knowing, because I graduated with a history degree with a concentration in African American studies at a North Carolina HBCU, you know, North Carolina Central, and I felt like I got an incredible education. I had some of the greatest professors that I've ever had, Carlton Wilson and Freddie Parker, who is, an expert on runaway slaves. That's actually what his research is on. But even with all of that and all the material we covered, we never got into Abraham Galloway. And like Mike said, Abraham Galloway is extremely significant, but he's one of many. They're doing a better job now, I think, with representations of resistance of African Americans with regards to slavery. But if you go back, I mean, most of the stuff is trying to create a narrative that never existed. For example, you take Gone with the Wind. There was no happy black mammy running around. Oh, Scarlett, they try to make it almost like there was some kind of, like the blacks were happy, you know, this whole narrative. And, you know, there had been resistance. And not only resistance, but everything that you can think of to stop resistance, some of the most horrors that we don't talk about, things like the slave breaking grounds, where they would take the slaves before they came to America in the Caribbean and basically torture them, you know, rip babies from pregnant mothers, you know, spend all this, the things to intimidate, to repress that. There's a whole book written by Willie Lynch, which talks about he was a famous slave breaker with how you break a slave. We don't get these stories. And history is the biggest unveiler of how we can move forward. But you can't talk about racial reconciliation when you have millions of people who don't really understand what the reconciliation is even about.
So let's backtrack a second, because just like I didn't know about Abraham Galloway, it's new territory for a lot of people. So talk to me about who he was, why he's significant.
Abraham Galloway is significant for a lot of reasons. He was a slave in Wilmington, is where he starts out. And as you know, Wilmington is a port. And he was, I really hate to use this word, I'll say better. His situation was better than a field slave because he was a mason. He was trained as a mason, and his master would loan him out to do work. But at the same time, his master also had two women slaves who were abused by his wife. And usually we can surmise when that's going on, it's because of something that the master was doing that the wife didn't appreciate. She couldn't take it out on the master, so she took it out on, you know, and that's not an uncommon story in these kinds of situations. But anyway, Galloway would pass the auction block and he would see slaves getting sold. He also had a very good friend who was a slave who was loaned out as a barber. And it came out that this barber, his friend, was secretly married to a biracial woman, you know, which was also a slave. So anyway, the result of that was that he was going to be beaten 40 lashes or something. And can you imagine 40 lashes across your back? So him and Galloway, also because Galloway felt that his owner was not very good with money, that it was just a matter of time before he would get sold. And so him and his friend decide to escape. And they escape by hiding, and they are able to pay off a boat captain, and they hide behind these barrels of turpentine on the ship. And the slavers knew that slaves were escaping in this way. So one of the techniques that they would do is that they would pump smoke into the compartments of the ship where slaves could hide or where people would hide. And you would have a choice. You could either come out and be caught or choke to death on the smoke. This is just the ingenuity of people trying to get free. They had Galloway had come up with a plan where they were going to use hog intestines to create a kind of very rude gas mask, if you will, so that if this was done, they would be able to survive the smoke. But for some reason, they didn't smoke out the hole that day, and they were able to escape. However, the other part about this is that, you know, the turpentine barrels have extremely, if you've ever smelled turpentine before, so for days they were inhaling this turpentine fumes. And some say that, you know, that would eventually might have been what led to Galloway's death, as the damage done to his lungs, etc. But that's just one theory. It's also a theory that he was poisoned. I mean, you could take your pick. To bring this up a little bit, they get to the north. Galloway makes it all the way to Canada, where he set up, I mean, the abolitionists on both sides of the border, once slaves got to Canada, they would have them set up with a job, you know, whatever they needed so they could start their life. And so Galloway, because he was a mason, you know, his opportunities were vast. What makes him special is that he didn't stay in Canada. He couldn't bear the thought of his mother, his family still being enslaved. So he decides to go back and become a part of the abolitionist movement. He gets involved in that. And it's not all like, you know, people running and hiding. I mean, it's actually gun battles, is, you know, taking on slave patrols, gunfights, all of that, you know. You can kind of think of him like a guerrilla Rambo in the way that they would, you know, sneak slaves out. They would hit plantations and burn down barns, you know, all these methods of resistance. And so Galloway was one of the best. When the Civil War starts off, the North, as you know, is not doing too great. And Lincoln is having to decide whether or not to include Black troops. The reason that, in my opinion, that Lincoln brought the Black troops in is because he knew that this could really break the back of the Confederacy. If they started leaving to fight for the, or doing, you know, that it could really benefit, and they were losing. And so Galloway, because of his reputation as a guerrilla fighter, as a strategist, as just a, you know, a badass, for lack of a better way of putting it, to give you an example of his badassery, he was doing missions for the Union as a spy, and they sent him to Mississippi. So he goes to Vicksburg, and, you know, Lincoln has actually said that if we, the key to winning the Civil War is if we take Vicksburg. And so Galloway went to scout, and he sent back a report saying that, you know, Vicksburg, we don't have what it takes to take down Vicksburg because of where the guns are. There's no way you can go around, et cetera. So the general decides that what they'll do then is they'll dig a ditch, a trench, and drain the river, the Mississippi River. And that will allow them to do what they need to do. Well, that was a dumb idea. So dumb that, you know, first they start with the white troops digging the ditch. They get sick and die. Then they get the blacks and slaves who have escaped to the Union lines to dig the ditch. And then, you know, they get a good rain and it collapses and a bunch of people die. So basically, the North decides to pull out of Vicksburg for the time, but they leave Galloway there. So he's in the middle of the Confederacy by himself. No one knows how he was able to do it. He was taken prisoner, but he was able to escape from a prison camp or however they held him and get all the way from Mississippi back to New Bern, North Carolina on foot. He shows up back in New Bern half dead, but the underground network there and the North has taken Wilmington at this time. He's able to, you know, they're able to bring him in, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, long story short, what makes him so valuable, or one of the other things that makes his story so valuable, is that Lincoln sends one of his top men to Wilmington to get Galloway's help in recruiting African-American runaways and freedmen to join the Union. Well, because the Union basically left Galloway for dead, he's not a fan of the Union, but he realizes that the only way that they can beat the Confederacy is to get as many black troops as they can into the war effort. And so after his speech, which is held in an attic, and they actually have Lincoln's man tied up in the attic, to explain to him how it's going to go down, Galloway convinces all of these African-Americans to join in the Union effort. And after that, he would go on to become a state senator. He was a proponent of women's rights. He won with a lot of white votes as part of this populist movement that was really beginning to take shape, which, of course, people were scared to death of. Now you got whites who have been disenfranchised and blacks who have been shitted on forever coming together. This is a problem. We can't have this, right? And so Galloway was kind of at the one of those leaders of that populist kind of movement. At the time of his death, he had the biggest funeral, I think, in the history of North Carolina. If you could put Malcolm X back in the 1800s, you know, there's a lot of that fire and spirit in Abraham Galloway. Or I should say it's Ed Malcolm, you know, because he came later. But that's kind of the energy that he had. But I mean, you could write a book on just the resistance movement, the complexity of it, the people involved, you know, on both sides of the color line. These were some fearless, you know, some fearless folks.
It's so interesting to me because as a white person, your mind goes to Harriet Tubman. That's who we know. She gets the good press. Why don't we remember others like Galloway in the same way that we learn about and hear about a person like Harriet Tubman?
Power wants to hold on to power. And in trying to hold on to power, or in being able to hold on to power, it's much easier to hold on to power if people think you are the most powerful, right? And citizens, students, children, you know, we get fed a meal that is easily digestible. And that's what we are taught in through history books, right? It's why the Tulsa Massacre is only just now being called the Tulsa Massacre. Why it's only just now being taught in general, it's because those in power would have, A, they suppressed the story, but B, you know, in telling that story, white folks don't look so good.
There's nothing more threatening. I mean, we see this by all these unarmed black men getting killed in the American psyche than this out of control, enraged, super strong black man, you know. And so I think that Galloway is more threatening in that way. And that's part of the reason he's left out. And then also with Harriet Tubman, we have to remember that, you know, she was blessed to live a pretty long life. And Galloway died in his early 30s. But more so than that, if you look at the story of Harriet Tubman, it's way watered down. It's way, way watered down. There's an excellent biography out about her now. Mm-hmm. And the movie, the recent movie, does a decent job. Or usually when you get the idea of Harriet Tubman, the way it's been portrayed is this old black lady, you know, that's, you know, walk around with a cane, leading people on a trail, you know. When Harriet did that stuff, she was a young woman and she was carrying a gun. She was a guerrilla fighter. You know, she did war strategy for the North. She just didn't go sit around and spy on people. She led charges. But that's not the Harriet Tubman that we get. So we don't get any of Galloway, and we get a very watered down. It's kind of the same thing they did with Rosa Parks. You know, you think Rosa Parks was this little old black lady that was tired. We don't know that she was in the movement, that she had studied nonviolent protest, that she was training people. Most people don't know that story because that narrative doesn't fit a narrative that can be like, we had this period in our country and we overcame it, and now America has fit, you know. I think I can't speak for all black people, like nobody can speak for all anybody, but I would, in my opinion, say, you know, with the majority of black people, it's not America. It's the pursuit of the possibility of what America can be. Sometimes the words are more powerful than the people that write them. And within those words, there is possibility in the Constitution. There's possibility. There's, you know, and that is what I think the majority of African Americans hang on to during these times of, you know, seeing people get, you know, killed by police and all the other issues that we deal with. You know, I think one of the things, not to just go on, that COVID has taught us is a little bit more about class, right? Because when you think about, so why are so many black people dying of COVID? Because so many black people work in the so-called essential worker industries, right? So they're in the supermarket, so you can stay at home, you know, and send your Dash guy to go pick up your groceries. So they're getting this, you know, so that's why you have one of the reasons you have such a high number of COVID cases in black and brown communities, because they're the essential workers. Hopefully, you know, we still believe in the possibility. I never thought I'd see a black man president. I never thought I'd see a black vice president. Things are not what they were in my father's time, but things have to get a whole lot better than they are now for our children.
One thing that concerns me is because we have seen over the course of the pandemic, this uprising in the We See You White American Theater movement. This season, many of our theaters are indeed creating programs and seasons that include Black and Brown stories. My concern is, as we move past this season, how do we keep our theaters accountable? And is this cultural shift that we're seeing on stage right now, is that going to stick?
They won't go back to programming the way they were programmed before if they want to keep black folks coming to their theater.
I think Mike is absolutely right. And I think that's the key. You know, at the end of the day, somebody told me it's a cliche, but it's true. Show business has two words, and business is longer than show. So if theaters are making money, then you will continue to see it. And part of that, you know, and the good thing about it is that, well, not the good thing, but one of the ramifications of suppressing these stories so long is that people are hungry for them, not just black people. You know, you don't see all of these black shows on Netflix because it's just black folks watching, right? America in general is interested in different stories that celebrate the, you know, which is really, in my opinion, the biggest strength we have is our diversity. And getting, you know, stories from other Americans, you know, from other American experiences is interesting to people across the racial spectrum because they haven't seen a lot of it before. And one thing about African-Americans, and I've seen this, and again, I'm not trying to, because you can't speak about any group of people as a monolith, But one of the successes we had in Durham was, you know, Man Bites Dog Theater, which has done a lot of my work. You know, Jeff and Ed are the greatest. And, you know, they always had, you know, Black people come into the theater. But, you know, after we did Shaughnessy Webb's play, I Love My Hair, and then Jay City, you started getting a lot of Black people coming to the theater. And it wasn't because Jeff and Ed weren't doing African-American work before then, because they were. But the reason they were coming to that theater now, well, with me personally, I already had an audience from Central. And so they came from the theater. And so now Black people who had never gone to that theater before, didn't even know that theater exists, were like, hey, this is the place where you can go and see Black stuff. Right. And so now you get a bigger Black audience, not just coming to see the Black plays, but coming to see, you know, because particularly with Man Bites Dog, because they will be always trying to push the envelope a little bit. So, hey, this is a place that's welcoming and safe for us. And they do our shows and they do good theater. And they built up and enlarged their African-American audience. And so I think the same thing happens when you do shows that represent communities, but then you also do the outreach to let them know this show is happening and this is a nice spot and you should come check it out, and you make the people feel welcome, then the people will come back. And there's nobody, you know, as loyal as a Black audience. I mean, you can do a whole lot of wrong and Black people will stick beside you, boy. I mean, it's still to the detriment sometimes. You know what I'm saying? I think one of the biggest fears that a lot of white theaters have is that if we bring this Black audience, we're going to lose the white audience. And that's not what happens. Right. What happens is you increase your audience. You know, Man Bites Dog didn't lose any audience because they did Mike Wiley and Howard Kraft shows. They kept the audience they had and they added to it, right? And so it's really an additive process. I mean, you look at the most successful shows on television, and they're the shows that have the most diverse cast. Mm-hmm. I think you have a lot of ageism also in you know, a lot of the white theater companies, in that this is where our target audience are baby boomers. And baby boomers want to see Fiddler on the Roof. And that's who's going to fill our house. And so that's what we're going to cater to. You know, people, regardless of age, they want thought-provoking stuff. You're not, and then the folks that just want the filler on the roof, I mean, those people, I mean, not to be cold or nothing, but they might not be here in the next 5 or 10 years, right?
But so, no, you're absolutely speaking the truth, man. Their audience is dying off. In fact, some of that audience might not come back after COVID. And I don't mean that in a morbid way. I mean, they might go, you know what? It's just not worth taking my health in a new enclosed place. Whereas a younger audience might go, yeah, I got to get out of my house. I got to get into somewhere that's showing me something that I want to see. Right. So really, it really is about catering to all folks, and not just once a year doing a piece that has some Black actors on stage. Right.
Or taking a traditionally white play and casting it with Black actors, but pretending that race would have no implication on the story. You know, it changes the play totally, because the play is also about the culture of the people. There's more than enough work. And there's so many Black stories and brown stories and that have not been told you know, you can increase your repertoire. And like Mike said, a lot of these plays that they're doing are plays from the 40s and 50s, you know. And I think what theater has to realize, whether they want to or not, a lot of this stuff was written before we had 150 television channels, before we had, you know, YouTube, before we had. So the American, I tell this to my students, the American attention span is not the same. I learned how to write plays by reading August Wilson. You can't put a typical August Wilson monologue in a play today because you lose the audience. It's too long. And we're just talking about the 90s. So the attention span is different. The rhythm is different. The flow that people move is different. But theater, a lot of theaters are still acting like, you know, it's 1950. You know, people want different. They want stories that reflect them. The reason those plays were popular, were so great, is because when they came out, they were in their time. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't doing plays from the 1800s, you know, they were doing that play. And that's why it was the play of that time.
Mike, talk to me about the significance of returning to the stage, for an in-person performance on Juneteenth, and not just any Juneteenth, but specifically Juneteenth 2021, because I feel like this feels significant to me.
It's a remarkable time to be a live performer and to come out of COVID or come closer to the end of it. I won't say that we have come out of it because I'm pragmatic, and I have been since the beginning of this thing. And maybe that pragmatism has more to do with the little faith I have in those individuals who either refuse to get vaccinated or don't believe that COVID exists, and so on and so forth. That society, that part of America that is in many ways selfish. So I'll just use the term coming to an end of a pandemic, or a place that we can be together. And so as a performer, as a live performer, it's exciting to be able to stand in front of an audience and commune in the way that live performers need to commune, and need to be able to tell stories. And also those audiences that crave the community that is, you know, a live performance, whether that is a concert or whether it is theater, you know, in many ways, it's all storytelling. And that's really what people crave. People crave live by the campfire kind of storytelling, right? Because you can get what you get from a Netflix or some other streaming service to watch films or television shows and so on, but you don't get that. What I think probably in many ways is just within our bodies, within our bones, within our souls, that need for in-person live storytelling by the campfire in the way that we have done for generations and centuries, right? That's what people crave. And it's not just the storytelling aspect of it that people crave. It is in many ways the communal feeling of being close to someone or close-ish to someone, to be able to look over and see that they're laughing at the same thing that you're laughing at, or they're crying or being emotional about the same thing that you are crying or being emotional about. I tell you, I've said this before, and I don't know if Howard has been around when I've said this, but one of the most fun things about being friends with Howard is going to either a performance or a live show, right? And that is because when he is enjoying something, he looks at you to see if you're enjoying it too. And right, if we're laughing at something that's happening on screen or excited about something, he will look at you and to see if you are laughing and enjoying it too. And that's what I miss. Right. That's what I miss about live theater in general, is that communal feeling of we're all in this together. Right. That's what we're missing, is that feeling of we're all in this together. Now, we've shown that over the last year in many ways, but now it's time to be there, to actually be in it together, to physically be in it together. And that's what excites me about standing on stage, and standing on stage, as you said, in celebration of Juneteenth, right? It's a freedom of sorts, right? It's mm-hmm. a newfound freedom of sorts, and being able to celebrate that together and share that and share in that is really what I'm looking forward to. And I think audiences are looking forward to that as well.
You can see Mike Wiley in Howard Kraft's play, The Fire of Freedom, this Friday, June 18th at Theatre Raleigh. The Fire of Freedom is also available as a touring production. For more information on scheduling or tickets, I'll put links in the episode notes. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to the podcast. Follow us on Facebook or Instagram at Beltline to Broadway, or Twitter at Beltline to B-Way, or visit us online at www.builtlinetobroadway.org. Until next time, I'll see you at the theater.